if you're getting worn out or if you're just sort of warming up.
I wanted to, before leaving Freemasonry, I didn't mean simply to be reading the encyclical. I was actually going to buy something else to read, besides he's nearly finished it, but I meant to read something else. Does anybody know the book Fat and the Great Conspiracy by Deirdre Manifold?
Yeah.
It's a good book. It covers a lot of ground too. But before leaving Freemasonry, I wanted to... There's an interesting passage here about the... it's in French, but I'll translate. The initiation, the effect of a Masonic initiation going into Freemasonry, and it really has an effect upon a person. According to this man, Jean Vacquier, was an expert on the secret societies. And it's an unpleasant thing. But I mean, a Mason is not the same as an ordinary man. He goes through something, especially if he takes it seriously. The more seriously he takes it, obviously, the more he goes through something. Obviously, a number of people, they're just, you know, they go through it like, they don't go through that. But if it bites at all, this is what happens. Initiation is a ceremony with a double effect. Firstly, it incorporates the newcomer into the brotherhood. Secondly, it projects a spiritual influence onto him. This spiritual influence produces upon the person initiated a certain number of psychological effects, more or less clearly perceived by him. These psychological effects constitute what Masons themselves call the initiate's illumination. The initiate's illumination, or enlightenment, if you like. The initiate enlightenment. What are precisely the psychological effects of this enlightenment or illumination? The Masons who have, in their works, described the mechanism of initiation, call this spiritual influence. They say that this spiritual influence, as it were, produces upon them a luminous and beneficent impression. Those are Latin words. A luminous means full of light. Beneficent means sort of makes you feel good. Yeah. It's a good feeling. And it's a good feeling. It's sort of, you feel light and you feel good. And the initiator produces this effect. That's the reason why they speak about an illumination. After being initiated, the person's thought is changed. His understanding of things is no longer the same. There really takes place in him a spiritual change. That's true. I'm sure that's true. Because Masons don't think about life the same way other people think about it. Back of it, ultimately, yes, is the devil. No doubt about it. A spiritual change. The Mason has, once and for all, adopted a new point of view, a new perspective, a new spirit. For him, the spectacle of the world is no longer illuminated by the same light. That what explanation do the Masons give on the nature of the spiritual influence which caused this change in them? We have to recognize that they hardly ask themselves many questions. And when they do ask any questions, they reply that the initiate spiritual influence is either of a gregarious nature, that's it builds them into a herd or a flock, it builds them into a congregation, a group, if you like, or a cosmic nature, so it builds them into the world, or both at once. Very interesting, very interesting. The Christian, if he will judge of these psychological and mystical phenomena, cannot do better than go and consult the masters of the spiritual life, especially St. Francis of Sales, St. Therese of Avila, and above all St. John of the Cross, who's been given the title of mystic doctor by the Church. They have described the conditions of the true divine mysticism. And at the opposite end, they uncover the influence of the devil on the contemplative paths, which depart from sane discipline of the spirit or the soul. If then we compare Christian mysticism and Masonic mysticism, such as it shows itself in initiation, we are bound to recognize that the spiritual influence which takes place with the illumination of being initiated is quite simply the spiritual influence of the devil. Certainly it looks as though it's full of light, and it feels good, because the devil is at work there, as he often is, transformed into an angel of light. There's nothing astonishing then if the joining in to his mystical body produces an impression of light and should feel like an illumination or enlightenment. But it's a false light, the true nature of which is darkness. Of course, the Mason initiated will never agree that he was illuminated by a devil and so darkened and so initiated into the mysteries of below. But the Christian who by his doctrine has the ability to discern the spirits will recognize in the descriptions of initiation, which are more and more widespread today, the true nature of this backwards illumination, like backwards masking in blood comes from the devil. I take an example. I don't know if any of you know the music of Mozart. The music of Mozart died in 1791. He was initiated into Freemasonry in 1785, about 6 years before he died. He was born and bred a Catholic. His father was a very pious Catholic under the great Catholic Empress Maria Theresa. But then Maria Theresa was succeeded on the Habsburg throne by Joseph II, who was an enlightened, who was deeply influenced by the humanist and Masonic ideas. And when Mozart went to Vienna in 1781, he fell very much under the influence of the Enlightenment and of Josephism. And Mozart was kind of, in his ideas at the time, he was left-wing, just like Beethoven was left-wing, just like many, many artists today are left-wing. That doesn't mean to say that their art is no good. Again, it's a contradiction. Left-wingery will destroy art, and good art will destroy left-wingery, in the sense of revolt. But you can't, revolt doesn't make art. Revolt destroys art, like iconoclasm. But about that time, Mozart's music is generally very gay and very bright. And, sorry, I shouldn't use the word gay. Very cheerful and bright. It's very sane. It's often quite light. It's not heavy. It's not dark. But about that time, between the Marriage of Figaro and Don Giovanni, it must be about 85, 86, I think Don Giovanni is 1787, Figaro I think is 1785. About that time, from the Kirchhoff 400s to the Kirchhoff 500s, a certain darkness comes over Mozart's music. The music is still beautiful. Make no mistake, it's beautiful. But there's a certain darkness comes over it. Down to and including the magic flute. It's never quite as simply cheerful as it used to be, let's say. That's just, and I'm sure that the Masonry has something to do with that. It's an interesting question. The music of Mozart in the Kirchhoff 500 and 600, it's deeper, if you like. There's a certain additional depth, but there's also an additional darkness, which there wasn't in the bouncy piano concertos of the 400s, you know. There's always a certain melancholy in Mozart, but it hasn't got that darkness, which it acquires 500. That's just an opinion, that's just a possible example. I wouldn't be at all surprised if that's what does explain. Now, I promise you that we will talk about socialism this afternoon. Are you protesting, Joseph?
Yeah.
Oh, in that case, I guess it will have to go on to Pascendi. Then, tomorrow is the feast of St. Pius X, September the 3rd, so we're hitting just right.
We having a high mass tomorrow.
Sorry?
Are we having a high mass tomorrow?
It'll be a sung mass, yes. If Father Rutigoiti can get some chant out of the seminaries, I think we have enough seminaries to sing, so it will be a sung mass, yes. Pius X was a very great man. We've lost our little decadence, but you know the pattern by now. The picture is the following. At the Reformation, half Europe goes kaput, Protestant. At the French Revolution, 1789,
The rest of Europe, the, all politics goes kaput. The politics of all Europe. So the half of Europe's gone, Protestant, and then with the French Revolution, with the French Revolution, the politics of all Europe goes kaput. That's to say, all politics, there's no longer throne and altar, the politics are no longer Catholic, the politics go liberal and Freemason, but the church holds on. Through the 19th century, that's the 1800s, the devil, the church, since the church holds on, the devil is attacking the church. And what he's above all got to do in the 19th century is get inside the church. And so, since the church, thanks to these anti-liberal popes, is standing strong, then the devil has got to infiltrate the church. He's got politics, he's got politics all over Europe, and then he's got Protestantism, which is even more of a good part of Europe. The church is still resisting. Remember, we're going down, 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 down. But the church is still resisting. He's got to infiltrate the church. The church is standing strong with these clear and good encyclicals. The popes are holding. Some people today say, if only the pope would hold. Perfectly true. But the age of the pope holding is over. The pope held for quite a long time when the rest of the church wanted to slide, and the pope held on. Pius X, Pius XI, Pius XII. And that held a lot of things up. It was a break on the slide. But after a given length of time, people wanted a pope to go their way, so the Lord said, all right, you have a pope the way you want. John the 23rd, Paul the 6th, John Paul the 2nd, and see how you like it, and see what happens. And that's what we've got now. So the age of the pope holding is past. But Pius X was very much an example of the pope holding, because the church was being infiltrated. The church was being infiltrated. That same bug, the same disease of Protestantism, which got into half of Europe, which then got in the form of Freemasonry, got in liberalism, got into all the politics, it's now worming its way into the church. It's going in disguise. The way it goes in disguise is that it's going to keep all the appearances of Catholicism, but the substance has changed. Imagine a pharmacy shop where, you know, all of the bottles of pills and medicines and ointments, they all have their labels and they're all colored. Imagine somebody in the middle of the night going into that shop, emptying out all the bottles, and putting in exactly the opposite. This is a bottle for your feet. It says ointment for the feet. He puts in an ointment for the head there. So the shop is completely changed, but when you go in, it looks completely the same. That's the trick that the devil is playing with the church in modernism. In other words, what's going to happen is the world is yanking at the church. Come on, join the party. Stop blocking our fun. Come on, join the party. And the church is saying, no, no, and the modern world is saying it's tugging and yanking, and then the priests are reading the newspapers, and they're reading too much newspapers, they're not reading enough breviary, and so they begin liking the way the world is going, and then there's a few bishops that get that way, and the devil is working at the church to corrupt the clergy. The Masons have, there's a very famous document from the 1820s, around that time, 1810s, 1820s, 1830s, from the Italian Freemasons, a very famous document. Of the Alta Vendita, the high sale, literally. And in this document, that one high mason is writing to another, what we need to do is worm our way inside the church to get the clergy on our side, until at last we get enough bishops that finally we get a pope, who, even if he doesn't belong to our ranks, nevertheless thinks like we do, and with him, behind, with cope and tiara, we are going to set revolution in the four corners of the earth. That was 1820 he was writing that. And that's exactly what we've got in the 1960s, 1970s, 1980s. Exactly. World revolution behind cope and tiara. The pope with his
Pope staff and the tiara. He's, of course, he's now trashed that, but anyway, it's still the Pope. The Pope with his tiara and his coat is causing revolution in the four corners of the earth.
Didn't he predict it in 1935? When he was the nuncios in Paris, later Pope John the 23rd,
Monsignor Vercelli,
that he would not, John the 23rd, that one high mason in France was saying, we have to make that he becomes the Pope and then be in the church. Mm-hmm. You know,
the Italian masons were saying it back in the 1820s, and that the plan was right there. You can read it. If I can get hold of the document, it's fairly, if you find any book about the subversion of the church, you're almost sure to find that document. How many of you know that particular speech? That particular writing? You know, one or two of you. It's quite famous, and it's extraordinary, because it's exactly what's happened. So, the Masons are hard at work infiltrating the clergy, corrupting the clergy. And the clergy, in order to stay Catholic, and yet to go with the world, which you can't do, the trick is to keep the Catholic labels, but to have the content going with the world. And that is the essence of the error of modernism. Modernism means updating the church by keeping the labels, keeping the tickets, keeping the words, but changing the content. And so when you talk, for instance, about the resurrection, you use the word resurrection, and you're quite happy to say, I believe in the resurrection. But a modernist doesn't mean Jesus' body actually coming out of the grave. And he would say that doesn't matter. He would say what? But the resurrection means something spiritual. Notice the weasel words. He says it doesn't mean just something physical and material like a body coming out of the grave. What does that matter? What matters is things spiritual. And the resurrection of Jesus Christ is Jesus living in the hearts of Catholics. Right? That's the resurrection. That is Jesus risen again, and that's what I believe in. And that's more spiritual than the old stuff about a body coming out of the grave. You follow the trick? And so you use the word, the old word, but the content is completely different. And so you see, take a look here, modernism is on two pages. We'll look very, very, very swiftly. Just turn over the second page, for example. Take the 1, 2, 3, fourth column from the left. I'll explain all this in a few moments. You've got negative, positive, and then faith in inverted commas, revelation in inverted commas, supernatural in inverted commas, dogma in inverted commas. Why all of these in inverted commas? Answer, because the old word is being used, but the content is now completely different. The content is being completely changed. Okay, so that's an example. I gave you the example of resurrection. Here you've got tradition a little further down in inverted commas. All of these things, the words, the same words, but a completely different meaning. That's the essence of modernism. So modernism is a way for, at last, finally, even the church to get with the movement of revolt without seeming to. You keep the appearances, but inwardly it's completely changed. Unfortunately, Cardinal Ratzinger is exactly that. Cardinal Ratzinger says things which a Catholic might say, but what Cardinal Ratzinger means by them is something completely different. It's terrible. And that ambiguity is simply instinctive in him. It's just instinctive. It's not something he's thinking of all the time. It's just the way he lives. And he's a decent man. I think. You know, it's not a question of attacking him or saying he's a villain, he's a nasty guy. I think he means well. But it's not a question of whether he means well. The question is, what are his ideas? What does he really believe in? That's what matters. And what he doesn't, I don't think he has the Catholic faith. And there would be a book downstairs of which, you know, to quote.
He was a parody at Vatican II, you know.
Yeah. He was a pupil of Karl Rahner, yes. Yeah. He was in with the wrong guys. However nice he was absolutely in with the wrong guys. He was a pupil of Karl Rahner. Alright, now let's have a look at the two pages, which is the to taking part. What happened then was that this infiltration of the third church got going, especially in the 1890s and in the early 1900s. And this movement was just beginning to get on a roll. And then in 1903, Pius X became Pope. And very nearly, a member of the secret societies was elected in the conclave of 1903, Cardinal Rampolla, who is, it's now known, was high up in the secret societies. But at the very last moment, the Emperor of Austria threw in a veto, which he still had the power to do in a papal election. The Emperor of Austria, Franz Joseph, threw in a veto, and that's blocked Rampolla. And then the votes began to build up for Pius X, and as Pius X was elected. Pius X, when he was elected, the intellectuals thought, he's just a parish priest. Because that's exactly what he had been. Pius X is a marvelous and sublime story. He went right from the very bottom. He went up every rung of the ladder. About at 7-year intervals, he was regularly promoted to the next. He went from parish priest, from sidekick to parish priest, to dean, to canon, to bishop, to cardinal, he just went regularly all the way up the ladder. And so the intellectuals thought he'd be a pushover. And they scorned and despised him, and they said, he knows nothing, he's just a parish priest. Pius X was a saint, a great saint. He reigned from 1903 to 1914, 11 years. In those 11 years, he did a tremendous work of bringing the church truly up to date into the 20th century. Pius XI and Pius XII largely followed in his tracks. And he showed what you have to do in order to keep the church. And he saw this snake slithering through the grass. It had a diamond green back so that you could almost not notice it. But Pius X had very sharp eyes, and he saw what a snake it was. And he saw just how poisonous and how deadly dangerous it was. And he wrote this encyclical, which you'll see if you read it in moments. There are moments when he, like Gregory XVI, he raises his voice. He says he doesn't say things like these creeps, these jerks, these nerds, these snakes, because popes don't say things like that. But he says everything but. He says they are striking the very heart of the church, and they're evil men. And he's right. He scotched the snake, and the tail slithered and quivered, and it sort of shot back into the undergrowth and hid there. Because Pius X had got their number. And he scotched modernism. It slithered back into the undergrowth. And it just waited, it lay underground, because Pius X had shown the real enemy. It lay underground waiting for its moment. Its moment came with John XXIII, and then up came modernism again in a slightly changed form, and that's neo-modernism, and that is what is devastating the church today. And that's why this encyclical concerning the church today, this encyclical, difficult though it is the one book or booklet that will tell you the most about what's happening in the church today. Let's have a look at how it's built. Look at the first page. You've got one fascendi on modernism, and then you've got two fascendi, the heart of the matter. You'll see how that works. We're going to be flipping over the page and back a little. Have all of you got a copy there? Because there is a spare copy here, if anybody's missing their copy. No. All right. Introduction in five sections this time. Introduction as usual, why this encyclical is having to be written, what the problem is. Two, the errors of doctrine. The errors of doctrine. That's the big Roman one. And then you've got big Roman two, the causes. That's the third section. Big Roman three, the remedies. That's the fourth section. And then conclusion is the fifth section. Not very difficult. Then, you see so we're in five sections. Introduction, doctrine, causes, remedies, conclusion. Now, you'll notice that the doctrine is the biggest section, especially when you realize that the beginning of that, 6 to 28, is in fact over the page. So you see 6 to 28, the heart of the matter. So you see, we read the encyclical runs paragraphs 1 to 4 on the first page, 6 to 28 on the second page, and then back to 29 or 30 down to 57 on the first page. You follow? So that you can see then how hugely more important the section of doctrine is than the section on causes or remedies. The section on doctrine, which is the second section, is not only more important, it's also much more difficult.
You have to start getting into philosophy, but I think you'll be interested, and I think you'll be able to follow what goes on, because it's of vital importance. In brief, the problem of modernism is what I call usually a mind rot. It's a corruption of the mind, so that the mind is afloat. You are capable of thinking that day is night and night is day, and instead of thinking that day and night is night, which is common sense, you become capable of thinking that day is night and night is day. You are capable of, the mind is so unhinged, it's so afloat. In modern philosophy, the mind is so dissolved. It's like somebody, you take a spray can of squeegee brain, and you sort of put it in somebody's ear, and and then his brain goes sort of squeegee. And modernism is one of the products of the disease of squeegee brain. And if you think about it, you'll recognize that squeegee brain, as I'll call it, these dramatic phrases, well, they're colorful and they make you think and remember. Squeegee brain is a disease which is all over the world today. And I'll be interested when if you can come up with a few examples on your own. But modernism is squeegee brain inside the church. For instance, the new mass, sometimes you'll hear the priest saying, it's exactly the same as the old mass, there's no difference at all. Then you'll hear the priest saying, the new mass is completely renovated. According to squeegee brain, it's exactly the same and completely renovated, both at once and at the same time. The two contradict one another. If it's completely renovated, it's not the same. If it's completely the same, it's not renovated. But these modern priests are capable of thinking, and you know your parish priests, they're decent men, but they seriously think, maybe out of obedience because they're told to think, that the new religion is exactly the same as the old religion, there's no change, and yet it's completely changed. It's completely changed because they tell you, you've got to change and get with it. But Father, in that case, it's changed. No, it isn't, it's exactly the same. Hey, wait a moment, Father. If it's exactly the same, then it hasn't changed. And if it's changed, it isn't the same. Obey! You're being divisive. Get with it. Stop being rebellious. Yeah? That's what I call squeegee brain. And the problem of the modern church is, and the problem of the modern world, is that people's brains have gone soft, and they can no longer think. And cats are no longer cats. Cats can also be dogs. I feel that cats are the universe. That's squeegee brain, right? Things are no longer what they are, which is old-fashioned common sense. A nail is a nail, a hammer is a hammer, tea is tea, coffee is coffee, the sun is the sun, the moon is the moon. No. Everything now is, I feel that everything is everything, and the moon is a cup of tea, and the sun is my psyche. That's the way the modern world works, and that is modernism. Modernism is that disease. We'll have a look at it. Right, now, then, notice the Pope going for doctrine, and the heavyweight, the real crunch is doctrine. It's not morals. Morals is a picnic compared with doctrine. Doctrine is the heavyweight stuff. I found a very interesting quotation of reading of George Washington. George Washington said, don't expect to uphold morality if you haven't got religion. Don't think that you can keep a nation by undermining religion and then keeping morality. And George Washington said it won't work. Unfortunately, George Washington, although he believed in religion, didn't believe in the true religion. And that's why that's why the Republic he founded was built on sand. You can't say anything else. Anything built on religious liberty will be built on sand. Religious liberty is, according to the time that we will have, we have 2 full days, Friday and Saturday. Religious liberty is a key question which I'd really like to go into Friday and Saturday. Together with the time, we'll take the time it needs on modernism, because this is a big one. And then after we've hit modernism, we'll have a look. We'll go on from the beginning of this century to Vatican II and religious liberty. We may backtrack to Leo XIII's encyclical on liberty, which is here. And then we'll come forward to Vatican II and the decree on religious liberty. And we'll see how people's minds are just, Catholic minds, are completely dissolved. They're just, there's nothing there. It's just all, it's just feeling. It's liberty, feeling. There's nothing there. There's no doctrine there. Therefore, the problem is doctrine. And that's why the Pope spends the whole of the second page and a good chunk of the first page on doctrine. Causes 40 to 43, it's easy. It's the causes of modernism, he says, curiosity, pride, and ignorance. And then rebelliousness against authority, and they work very hard to spread their modernism. That's the causes. Not a very big problem. Easy section. The remedy is pretty easy. Interesting guy, we need censorship. The Pope wants censorship? You know, the modern mind gets the jitters. The very idea of censorship for the modern mind, you know, liberty, liberty, liberty. Censorship is terrible. No, it isn't. All depends who's doing the censoring. If a communist is doing the censoring, yes, it's terrible. But if a Catholic is doing the censoring, not only is it not terrible, it's essential for the sanity and welfare of a society. Books today are very strictly censored, and newspapers. You try putting in a newspaper that the Holocaust is a big lie. See what happens. It won't go in. And there's a lot of other things that won't go into the newspaper. Right? There's a very strict censorship on today's newspaper. The clever thing is that it's disguised, so you think we've got liberty. We think we've got liberty in the newspapers and everywhere else. We haven't at all. There's a very strict censorship on all kinds of things, and you are not allowed to suggest that the Holocaust is false, that there were not 6 million Jews deliberately gassed by the Nazis. You're not allowed to think that, even suggest it. And that's a strict censorship. I just quote that as an example. Whether there were 6 million Jews gassed or not, you are not allowed to suggest it. That you're not allowed to suggest. You're absolutely allowed to say that it's true. You are absolutely not allowed to say that it's a hoax. You're not allowed to say that in the media. Television is strictly censored. And the moment somebody started stepping really out of line, they'd turn off the juice, they'd turn off the current, they'd switch to the anchor man, they'd do anything you like, but they will not have a lot of things going out over the waves. It's very strict censorship. And the clever thing is that people think they're in freedom, and in fact they're under strict censorship. It's not a Catholic censorship, that's the problem. So that what today they yell and scream and hate any right-wing censorship, but there's a very strict left-wing censorship. Only people don't notice it because they're too dumb. And the people that have imposed it are smart. Why are people so dumb? Anybody give me the answer? Why do the great mass of people not notice that they're being led by the nose by these characters? Reuben?
Well, they're ignorant.
They're ignorant. Why are they ignorant? What's the essential reason why they're ignorant?
They don't love truth.
They don't love truth. It's very profound. That's exactly it. They do not love truth. What do they love?
Popularity.
Popularity.
Public opinion.
Public opinion.
Hollywood.
Hollywood. Pleasure. Pleasure and greed. Back to power.
Money talks. With money you can present.
Money talks and something else walks, right, Reuben?
Indeed.
Right. We have in fact, so what Pius X is in his remedies, the first thing he calls for is interesting, is Thomism, the study of St. Thomas Aquinas in the seminaries. Notice the remedy, he goes straight to the church. He doesn't go to the laity, he goes straight to the church. The church is from the church that the remedy's got to start. Therefore, Scholasticism, St. Thomas, especially metaphysics. Let the cleric so learn theology as to love it. Let natural sciences be studied, but not as to neglect. So he goes to the church, and he goes to the question of studies. In other words, he goes to the question of truth. He goes to the question of doctrine. That's the heart of the matter. It's not a question of sorting out how the laity behave. It's a question of sorting out how the priests, especially the future priests,
think and what they believe and whether they've got hold of the truth. If the clergy have the truth, the laity will get the truth. It's the clergy with that's where he starts. 48-49, choose very carefully the directors and professors for seminaries and universities. No novelties, no pride. Let proud priests be excluded. Then it wasn't necessary. But no publications of modernists or of Catholics imbued with modern philosophy. Bishops, drive, and then he comes to censorship, drive out of your dioceses all pernicious books. Ideas matter. Books matter. As I say, these criminals that are corrupting us today, they know that ideas matter. That's why they so strictly censor the media, to stop even a breath of the hollow hoax coming out. Let there be censorship with censors. Let no priest edit without his bishop's permission, without his control. Let there be no priest meetings without the bishop's consent. No democracy. No popular movement of the priests against their bishops. The bishops are in control. The bishops are going to govern. To ensure the execution of this program, let councils of vigilance be formed to hunt down modernism. Wow! You know, he wants to turn the church into a police state, but this is a saint. Why is it necessary to church potential to turn the church into a police state? Anybody? Quasar.
He subverses our clever.
That's exactly it. The subversives are so clever. The world is so corrupt. We're reaching the bottom of the thing. The world is so corrupt in 1907 that the enemy is so clever. They are real, literally snakes in the grass. You've got to have a snake watch. You've got to have somebody with very sharp eyes to pick up these characters. Because the world is so corrupt today, and it's got a lot more corrupt since 1907.
That man had a sharp eye.
Pius the Tenth had a sharp eye.
Yes.
And you need to keep the faith today. Imagine what it needs then to keep the faith today. If Pius the Tenth said, we need a snake watch, what do you need now? You need a snake x-ray, you need night vision, you need everything to pick up these snakes, because now, wow. Let's have a look, go on. Vigilance committees, that's safe. His enemies immediately accused him of setting up a police state. But hey, needs must. Necessity is the mother of invention. If that's the only way you're going to defend the faith, then that's what you've got to do. The faith has to be defended. And the situation is very grave. You read Passion of Yourselves and you see the gravity with which the Pope picks up the situation. You know, you could have been, in 1907, you could have said, oh, the church is strong, the church is hunky-dory, everything's wonderful, look at it, all marvelous. The Pope says, we are in danger. And he hits the panic button. Bang! And all the alarm bells are going off in this encyclical. It's very, very grave. Thanks to him, what did the cunning enemy do? They immediately went back underground. And they pretended to have disappeared. And you could read a book of encyclicals in the 1930s or 1940s, and very possible that the encyclical on Pascendi won't even appear. And what did the professors in the 1930s and 1940s and 1950s write about modernism? Anybody know? What kind of thing did they write about it? They wrote nothing, more or less nothing. They said, oh, it was a little problem in Pius X's day. It disappeared. And of course, it's surprising he made really such a fuss about it, but it disappeared, so it's not a problem now. But it's a rot which was, it's in the air we breathe. Modernism is in the air we breathe.
It was probably Cardinal Ratzinger who called the arguments expressed as
the antisyllabus.
Yes.
The antisyllabus. That's along the same line of thinking. Yeah. So you can see what, I'm really jumping to the end, but that's just to show you that the section on remedies is not difficult, the section on causes is difficult, the nitty-gritty is the section on doctrine. But let's start with the introduction. We popes must guard the faith and we must feed the flock. That's why the encyclical is called Pascendi. It's Pasco, Pascere, Pastum, where from where we get the English pastor, also pasture, a pastor and pasture. We both get both those words from Pasco Pascendi. So we must feed the flock. The Pope is aware that he's got to look after the people and give them good pasture. Especially today, panic button. Brrr. The enemy is within. Brrr. Read that. Read these paragraphs. Intimate. He's right inside the church. Radical. Disguised. Audacious. outwardly correct. Oh, he's ever so correct outwardly. Disobedient. Leniency has proved ineffective. There's an H missing there. Leniency has proved ineffective. We tried we tried to be nice guys with these people. Didn't work. Now we must strip off the mask. The time is over for being nice with these characters. We need the stick and the cane and the whip. Hence, we're going to give you a fashion. That's where this is accused. We have got a grave problem burrowing away in the very heart of the church. Dry rot. We've got dry rot inside the church, and it all looks good, and the surface is all beautiful there, but the timbers are rotting from inside. We've got termites and dry rot. And we've got to tear the building apart in order to get the dry rot out. Otherwise, it's all going to collapse, as the Pope. Hence, three main sections: the teaching of the modernists, the causes of modernism, and the remnants of modernism. Let's have a look at. We turn over. Well, no, don't. Before you turn over, look at the whole section of on doctrine. You've got the whole picture on page one, and then you've got the breakdown of the first part on page two. On page one, the Pope says he's going to analyse the modernist under seven aspects. The modernist, firstly, as philosopher. Secondly, as believer. Thirdly, as theologian. Fourthly, as historian. Fifthly, as critic. Sixthly, as apologist. Seventhly, as reformer. And then he comes to his conclusion, which will be that modernism is the synthesis of all heresies. You take Nestorianism, Arianism, Lutheranism, Eutychianism, Pelagianism, all the errors, all the big errors of the church, Donatism that you can think of, run them all into one, and you've got modernism. That's saying quite a lot. Now, no wonder if modernism is all the heresies run into one. The main sewer carrying the muck from all the minor sewers. All sewers are like a sewer is like a heresy. All the filth. Modernism was the main sewer collecting together all the filth. That's one of the comparisons of modernism. So we've got a problem. We got a problem, says the Pope. Notice the order of those. He doesn't even start with the theologian. He starts with the philosopher. Way before the historian, the critic, or the apologist. What the apologist means will come to. He starts with the philosopher. It's ideas that matter. He goes on to the believer and then the theologian. Turn over the page. And then he goes, only then does he go on to the historian, the critic, and the apologist. Those are minor points. The biggie is the philosopher and the theologian. And the believer is like the transition from the philosopher to the theologian. We look at the section on philosopher then. Philosopher, the problem of modernism is today's mind rot. It's not a problem of theology. It's not even a problem of theology. It's a problem of philosophy. It's a problem of people's minds. People have got squeegee minds or rubber minds. There's nothing fixed and steady there. There's no anchor for truth. People don't believe in truth any longer. People believe that everything just slips and slides and changes and moves. And it's what I feel that matters. Truth is what I feel. Right? And that's very, very widespread. Truth is no longer what I think. Truth is what I feel.
So experience is source of truth.
Absolutely.
And I am the supreme judge of this experience.
Absolutely. Because my experience comes from within me. Therefore, I am king of the castle.
Is it called the vital immanence?
Vital immanence, we'll come to that.
Yeah. Oh, I thought that was already that. Isn't that the feeling?
That's it.
Yeah.
That's it. Well, so let's have a look. Then let's come to the philosophy. You see, you've got to understand what philosophy is. Philosophy is not just a few old men cranking out dusty books in a university. That's not what philosophy is. Every single man walking up and down the street, every single girl, every single boy, every single human being has a philosophy.
What you mean by philosophy is a system of natural beliefs on which he bases his natural life and on which he builds his supernatural life or builds his absence of supernatural life. That's what a man's philosophy is. For instance, a man's philosophy might be pleasure, pleasure, pleasure. In that case, he's going to immortal sin, immortal sin, immortal sin, and to hell with supernature. So the natural basis of his life is to do away with supernature. A Catholic, on the other hand, the natural basis of his life is the truths of nature on which grace comes to build, on which grace sits. The famous Latin expression is that grace does not take away nature. Gratia non tollit natura. Grace works with and builds with nature. It harmonizes and synchronizes with nature. It's completely different from nature. It's way, way, way above nature. Grace is a partaking in God himself. Supernature is a participation in God himself. Whereas nature is just all creation around us. Grace is God above creation. Completely different ballpark. But God created this nature to synchronize with grace, to be able to synchronize with grace as a carrier for grace. Just like you put whiskey in a glass bottle. The glass is cheap, the glass is vulgar, the glass is nothing compared with the whiskey. Try drinking broken glass. I mean, it's not really a very good thing to drink. Or gargling broken glass. But you need the glass just to carry the whiskey. How can you have whiskey without glass? You've got to carry the whiskey in something. And therefore, cheap and vulgar and meaningless though the glass is, when it's carrying whiskey, it's very precious. The difference between nature and supernature, the distance between nature and supernature is much, much less than the distance between, the distance between nature and supernature is much greater than the distance between glass and whiskey. Whiskey is more valuable than glass. Grace is infinitely more valuable than nature. But as precious as is and as necessary as the glass is to carry the whiskey, so precious and so necessary is the nature to carry supernature. You never saw the state of grace walking down the street. What you saw is always a human being in the state of grace walking down the street. You never saw a bottle of whiskey walking down the street with, or sitting in the cupboard without a bottle. You always see a bottle of whiskey in the cupboard. And without the bottle, there's no whiskey. Without nature, there's no supernature. For human beings, of course, there's God, but there's no participated supernature. Therefore, the value of nature is to carry supernature, and the two are meant to fit together. But grace does not take away nature. Grace presupposes nature. Like the whiskey to be delivered to your home presupposes some glass, so grace to be partaken of presupposes a nature to partake of it. And therefore nature is very valuable. If then the glass is always broken, imagine the whiskey manufacturer, his producer of glass produces bottles which are always cracked. What's the whiskey? He's going to say, this is no good, I can't put whiskey in that. You're fired, house. Imagine then, if the devil wants to stop supernature, what's the profoundest thing he can do?
Corrupt nature.
Corrupt nature. Attack nature. And that's what's happening today. People are so crazy mixed up, even just in their nature, that it's extremely difficult for grace and supernature to come down and find somewhere to sit in. People are so mixed up in their philosophy that their theology is bound to be crazy. And the problem is not a crazy theology, it's a crazy philosophy. And you've got to straighten out nature, but you've got to straighten out the glass before you dream of putting whiskey in there. Poor people today are so confused, even in a natural way. And that's why he starts with philosophy. Because the problem of modernism is squeegee mind, which is primarily a problem of glass and not primarily a problem of whiskey. We'll see that. Okay. Notice the section on the philosopher. Again, notice the big first distinction, the principles, running 6 and 7, and then the application, 7b through to 13. Notice again, the Pope then is going for doctrine in front of causes and remedies. He's going for philosophy in front of all of the rest. And when he gets down to philosophy, once again, in defiance of your practical, efficient, let's get real modern world, he's always going for the theory, the theory, the theory. Once again,
He's not interested in the application firstly. He's interested in the principles, and only then the application. Notice how the Catholics go for the ideas again and again, because ideas matter. Doctrine matters. Principles matter. So he goes for the principles. Then we might think, and I'll give you a secret, you'd be correct if you think, that paragraphs 6 and 7 are the key to the whole encyclical. The rotted principles of philosophy are the basis from which the whole encyclical runs, from which the whole problem runs. The problem of the modern world is a rotten natural principles, mind rot. Because when a man has got mind rot, when he believes that there's no such thing as truth, how can he straighten out his morals? It's not easy. Because so long as the mind presents the truth to the will can always straighten out. The will may be weak and it may be naughty, but at least it knows the truth. The truth is there for it to straighten out. But if the mind presents confused signals to the will, how can the will straighten out if it's only got confused signals? The mind is the highest thing in a human being. It's what everything else comes down from. Not the heart. Not the heart. Today people think that feeling and heart, just so long as you feel alright, just so long as you mean well, just so long as you're sincere, just so long as you've got a good heart, that's all that matters. Ideas don't matter. That's Protestantism. And it's deadly. And it's very, very common today. People think truth is... that's where truth is. It's just the heart. It's feeling nice. It's being nice. It isn't. But you try telling that to people today. You will hear again and again in one form or another, all that matters is the heart. For Pius X, no. What matters is the idea, the doctrine. What matters in doctrine is the philosophy. What matters in philosophy is the principles. And so, in paragraph 6 and 7, we've got the key to the whole encyclical. In the principles, you've got firstly the negative and then the positive. The negative rot and the positive rot. The negative rot is paragraph 6, the positive rot is paragraph 7. The negative rot is the time bomb, the atomic bomb. Paragraph 6 is the atomic bomb with which the mind rotters destroy and empty everything out of a person's mind. And then paragraph 7 is the shanty, the shack that they rebuild on the 6 is leveling the building site, the negative principle that destroys everything on the building site, that pulls down the World Trade Center. And then 7 is the shanty that they build in its place. So you've got the negative principle first, the negative key the mind rot, and then the positive key to the mind rot. And the negative comes in front of the positive, because the negative is what levels the building site, and then the positive is what puts up tents and shacks and corrugated iron in place of the palace which they blew up. So you might guess from that that the key of the key of the key is paragraph 6, and you'd be right. You've got two words there, phenomenism and agnosticism. And the error is, has two names or it has one name. You can call it phenomenism, or you can call it phenomenalism with an AL as well, friend, it doesn't matter. You can call it agnosticism, but it's a particular kind of agnosticism. Agnosticism is too broad and too general. Agnosticism simply means I don't know. Gnosis, I know, and agnosis, I don't know. So agnosticism is simply not knowing. But phenomenism is the heart of the problem. Phenomenism, we'll deal with that, we'll come to that this evening. What we've got is the modern philosophy of Immanuel Kant in particular. Pius X would say, il kantismo è l'eresia moderna. Kantism is the modern heresy. And we'll have a look at Kant after supper. But what we've got then is the particular kind of agnosticism which is phenomenist. What is phenomenist or phenomenalist agnosticism, that's the key to modernism, it's the key to the mind rot. A whole lot of people today are walking around with Kant inside their head and their soul without even knowing his name. You think that philosophy is just a matter of a few old professors and dusty books in some crummy university talking nonsense? Immanuel Kant is walking up and down every highway and governing every parliament and governing the world practically. Philosophers have an immense influence. We'll look at phenomenalist agnosticism this evening.